This week in the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. With the presidential election fast approaching, Donald Trump is in court in New York.
I should be out campaigning right now.
And Trump should have been present before the recent Supreme Court immunity case as well.
Trump can't be present because he's up in New York on trial in the most blatantly politicized prosecution that anyone's ever seen.
Plus, after a failed hostage deal, Israel makes its initial military move into Rafah.
Israel began to mount surgical strikes in Rafah, which is actually in keeping with Biden's request that we only have surgical strikes and not sort of a major offensive.
While President Biden withholds weapons for Israel.
You don't make allies like this, and you have to treasure it and do everything you can to make sure we win.
We've got all this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me, please, on X, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. We're going to begin with former President Trump and his court cases. The former president emerged from court earlier this week clearly frustrated. And he has every right to be frustrated.
This was a very big day, a very revealing day. As you see, their case is totally falling apart. They have nothing on books and records, and even something that should bear very little relationship to the case. It's just a disaster for the DA, for the Soros-backed DA. It's a disaster. This whole case is just a disaster. If you read the legal scholars, you'll see, because they're writing about it, they've never seen anything quite like it. And neither have I. I should be out campaigning right now. We're leading in all the polls. I'd like to be campaigning. We'll be leading by a lot more.
What we are watching is an absolutely shocking attempt by the trial judge, Juan Merchan, and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg to secure, by any means necessary, a conviction of the former president. Only mind readers can discern the real motives behind the judge's incomprehensible abuse of his powers. Merchan seems to me to be a partisan who's gone rogue. I've said it time and time again. The judge and Alvin Bragg are trying to convict the former president of concealing a crime that Trump has not even been charged with. We'll turn now to National Review's Andrew McCarthy. He was my guest earlier this week.
In criminal cases, I think they take their cues from the judge. And the unseen dynamic to me that's always been most important in a criminal trial is how the judge interacts with the government lawyers. And if the judge smells a rat and doesn't like the case, the jury knows that. On the other hand, if the judge trusts the prosecutor and the prosecutor looks like the prosecutor's playing it straight, then that's very powerfully influential over the jury. I don't mean to say that what the defense lawyers do is irrelevant, because it's not. But I think most cases are not won by flashy lawyering, or even just like good, solid lawyering. Most cases are decided by evidence and a straightforward application of what the law is. The unusual thing in this case is that to the extent there's mountainous evidence, it is evidence of lawful conduct. It's not hard for prosecutors to look like they're methodically building a case if what they're proving is something that doesn't break the law. You know, it's not hard to assemble evidence about that. And the most important thing in this case, which is the thing we have no read on yet, and I think we really should, is by now, both sides should have submitted to the judge what we call request to charge, which is the proposed jury instructions for the end of the case. It's really essential to know what it is that Merchan, Judge Juan Merchan, who's presiding here, is going to tell the jury about the essential elements of the crime, particularly the mystery crime that Trump is supposedly falsifying his business records to commit or conceal, which here we are in the third week of trial and nobody has a solid read on what that is yet.
Now, Andy, I mentioned my experience on a jury because there are two lawyers on this jury. And if Trump has any chance of a hung jury, I'm reposing it in those two lawyers who may be able to smell a rat. And in the way I just was astonished by what went on in my jury room. What do you think about two lawyers on this case? Will they be able to suss out that this is a railroad job?
You know, it really depends on the lawyers. I wouldn't make a categorical assumption about lawyers. I mean, look, if you're going to talk about Manhattan lawyers, which is what these people are, you know, they could be very discriminating lawyers who will see the problems with the state's case, which are immense. Or they could be the kind of lawyers who were lined up from Fifth Avenue to Guantanamo Bay to represent the jihad. You know, I don't know which ones they are. So, and they could also be lawyers who, you know, if this was a real estate transaction, you, instead of a criminal case, I'd be at sea. You know, yes, I'm a lawyer, but I might as well be, a cobbler for all I know about real estate.
Andy, I got to talk to you about not letting Brad Smith testify. I don't know much about experts. I got a lot of tort lawyer colleagues that were my partners when I practiced law. I'm retired now. And they knew about experts, and we talked about experts all the time. I cannot imagine not letting Brad Smith testify as to the unique nature of the prosecution's claim. What is going on? Brad Smith, former FEC chairman, law professor, expert of experts, and what has the judge done to him? He's gagged him, hasn't he?
Well, he's gagged him in the sense that he won't let him testify about the thing you would want him to testify about, which is if the prosecution is going to claim that Trump was concealing a campaign finance violation, you need to have someone who can explain campaign finance law. Now, Bragg shouldn't be in that position because he doesn't have any authority to enforce federal law. But since he's trying to sneak it into the case this way, you ought to have, you know, the whole reason that we have an FEC is to make sure that we have uniform application of the campaign laws throughout the United States. So to have a state district attorney basically, you know, invoke these laws and make up the law as he goes along, which is not consistent with how the Justice Department and the FEC enforce it, is a really bad thing. It's counter what Congress had in mind when they established these laws in the first place. And here, it's even worse because while the judge is not allowing Brad Smith to explain the law, he has allowed evidence from David Pecker, who was obviously not an expert in this area, who testified that he was fearful that he was in violation of the campaign laws, and that's why they signed a non-prosecution agreement with the Justice Department and why the American Media, Inc. Ended up paying a $180,000 fine to the FEC. And he's also allowing Michael Cohen to tell the jury that he pled guilty to two campaign finance charges under circumstances where it's black letter criminal law that one conspirator's guilty plea is not admissible to prove the guilt of another conspirator. In other words, Cohen's guilty plea should not be in front of the jury because they could be confused into thinking that because he pled guilty, that Trump must be guilty. So it's exactly the kind of evidence that's not supposed to come into the case. If he's going to allow Cohen and Pecker to instruct the jury about campaign law, then he ought to allow Trump to put somebody on who knows something about it, which is exactly what Brad Smith would add to the case.
You know, I thought your discussion with Rich about his refusal to allow Smith in and his failure to specify the indictment is the most plain spoken argument made. Are Trump's counsel allowed to make these arguments in closing argument, Andy? Can they say we weren't allowed to put in Brad Smith? Stormy Daniels went off the rail. Michael Cohen's plea shouldn't have been allowed in. We're going to challenge all that on appeal. Can they say that in closing argument?
Ordinarily, a judge would not let lawyers make legal arguments to the jury in summation if they depart from, you know, you're supposed to have the jury charge before summation so you know what the judge is going to tell the jury about the law. And if you're, in a trial, if you know you're going to make an argument to the jury and the judge is going to sustain an objection, that makes you look bad in front of the jury. So you don't want to be making arguments that the judge is going to sustain objections to. The idea is to preserve all those objections on the record at the charge conference, but I don't think they'll be able to make those arguments to the jury.
We're experiencing instability at every level. Our government lacks leadership, and Bidenomics has been a disaster. The economy is in a fragile state. Inflation has been a consistent issue. High interest rates have put significant pressure on the real estate market. There have been major bank failures, and many analysts say a stock market correction is likely overdue. We have global conflicts in Europe and the Middle East that have the potential to spread, but gold has soared to record highs even amidst the tensions. There are so many reasons that Americans should consider investments in gold and silver, and Legacy Precious Metals is the gold standard. I love Legacy Precious Metals because of their zero hassle, education first approach. They can help you roll your traditional IRA into a gold IRA or ship metals directly to your house. Go to legacypminvestments.com to download their free gold investing guide. I've read it and there's so much valuable information there. Friends, now is not the time to roll the dice with your hard-earned money. Find out about the growth potential that gold offers you. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today and tell them I sent you.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
That is unfortunate because I do think a good closing argument here would kill this case, even with a blue jury. But I don't think he's going to get to make it. Let's quickly run down the D.C. case, the Georgia case, and the Arizona case, Andy. We got about 4 minutes here. What do you see happening in those forums? I don't see anything happening because of the Supreme Court case.
I think the D.C. case is the only one that has a chance to go to trial, and it would depend on Jack Smith doing something that is very out of character from anything we've seen up until now. I thought you, in the Supreme Court argument on immunity, that John Sauer, Trump's lawyer, gave a lot of ground in terms of saying that there's a lot of information in the indictment that's private conduct that is not amenable of an immunity claim. If Smith really wants to get to trial, I think the Supreme Court's going to remand the case to Judge Chutkan to sort out what's private behavior and what's possibly immunized official executive behavior. Smith could short-circuit that by saying, you know what, here's what they've conceded is private. Let's just go to trial on what's private.
Andy, you're right. Now, the counsel, there is one other big deal I want to get to. Counsel for Jack Smith and DOJ, Mr. Dreeben, excellent advocate, as was Mr. Sauer, made a point of saying repeatedly the former presidents are protected by the processes of the Department of Justice. Put that aside. Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Barrett, at the end, brought up state prosecutors. And I think she seemed to intimate, we got to have a rule against state prosecutions of former presidents for acts, whether they're official or not official. Did that appeal to, did you hear that? I heard that very clearly, that she's got a lot of skepticism about local prosecutors and former presidents. And she's right to have that skepticism because it's a magnet for every headline hog in America who's been elected DA somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. I think Dreeben, if I'm remembering right, tried to make the point that there would be a supremacy clause issue.
Yes.
If you had state prosecutors go off the rails and do politicized prosecutions. But the thing I reject about his position is it seemed to me, I know Mike Dreeben a bit, and, you know, he's a very smart guy, I agree. But, to look the court in the eye and say, you know, you don't need to worry about politicized prosecutions because we have all these prosecutors take oaths, there are grand juries, we have all these safeguards. And as he's uttering those words, Trump, who has a right to be present in the Supreme Court argument on immunity, which is a pretrial issue, he's got a right to be present for that. He can't be present because he's up in New York on trial in the most blatantly politicized prosecution that anyone's ever seen. So even as his rights are being blatantly, unabashedly violated by both the federal and state processes, Dreeben is looking the court in the eye and saying that kind of stuff doesn't happen.
Coming up, the administration withholds weapons for Israel.
You don't make allies like this, and you have to treasure it and protect it and do everything you can to make sure we win.
Michael Lauren, in the next segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
This is Dennis Prager, and now a truly exciting new benefit. My monthly online video get-together for PragerTopia Plus members only. For an hour each month, get an exclusive chance to ask me anything. I'll be answering your questions. I've never done this. Submit your questions for me at PragerTopia.com. This is our chance to connect like never before. Go to PragerTopia.com or click the banner at DennisPrager.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's been over 7 months now since the terror group Hamas invaded Israel, killing some 1,200, torturing, raping, mutilating, 5,000 wounded. It took upwards of 200 hostages, including American hostages that we hear far too little about. Israel this past week saw Hamas reject a hostage deal that would have included a temporary ceasefire. The Israeli military began its move on Rafah, a city they must take. There are more than 10,000 and perhaps as many as 20,000 terrorists in that 25-square-mile city. Leaving Rafah untouched would invite the terrorists to regroup, rearm, metastasize, spreading throughout Gaza again. We'll turn now to Michael Loren, Israel's former ambassador to the United States. He was a guest of John Solomon on the John Solomon Reports podcast.
Well, let's begin with the South. Let's begin with happening with Gaza. Okay, so Israel, in a very controversial move for the government, tabled a proposal. That proposal was that Hamas would release 33 hostages. That's down from 40, with the understanding on the part of Israel that Hamas probably doesn't have 40 hostages that would meet the criteria of people who are old, infirm, women who are not soldiers, 33. In return, a 40-day ceasefire, the return of many Palestinian civilians to the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and the release of a very large number of Palestinian prisoners, some of them with blood on their hands, Israeli blood on their hands, from Israeli jails. Now, that offer was described by Secretary of State Anthony Blinken as extraordinarily generous. Hamas rejected it. Hamas rejected it because Hamas figures, Mr. Sinwar, is the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, understands that the Biden administration is saying to Israel that it cannot go into Rafah under any conditions. So with the United States seemingly restraining Israel, and the only means Israel has of effecting pressure on Hamas is by going into Rafah, Sinwar can sit pretty and it could afford to reject it. Then Hamas did something just remarkably cruel, miserable, and clever. That's what they do because they are evil, but they're not stupid. They shelled the border crossing through which much of the aid goes through. Right? It's called the Horn of Peace. And they killed four Israeli soldiers. They killed four Israeli soldiers on our side of the border, which was reminiscent of October 7th, not in Gaza. And what Israel had to do was to close that border, which meant aid was not going into Gaza anymore. And already the UN started complaining about a famine. And the United States begins to pressure Israel to reopen that border crossing, even though it's going to jeopardize the lives of our soldiers, because it was shelled again today by Hamas. So again, they're not stupid. What they do is they're going to create a humanitarian disaster in Gaza, and the world's going to forget why that crossing was closed, and they'll blame Israel. And more pressure will put on Israel to agree to a ceasefire without, without any preconditions, an unlimited ceasefire. So Israel began to move troops into Rafah. They took over the border area separating Egypt from Gaza, the Rafah crossing, because that is where all the arms, all the guns, and all the rocket-propelled grenades get smuggled in. So it was extremely important. And Israel began to mount surgical strikes in Rafah, which is actually in keeping with Biden's request that we only have surgical strikes and not sort of a major offensive. And Hamas began to get a little nervous. So Hamas then tabled its own proposal. And it didn't table it to Israel. It gave it to Egypt and to Qatar. There's some complaints in Israel that the United States knew about it and didn't tell us about it. And what that proposal says is it's an unlimited ceasefire. Basically, Hamas wins the war. It'll give back hostages, but only in return for Israel saying, listen, we lost. We're pulling out all of our troops, and Hamas can take over the Gaza Strip again and launch its next attack against Israel. So, of course, Israel's not going to accept that, but there's going to be certain people in the world, and you can imagine who is going to say, hey, listen, Hamas is ready to deal. Why are you attacking Rafah? Very clever. Meanwhile, in the north, two soldiers killed yesterday, massive bombardments from Hezbollah. And it does not seem to me in any way that the United States and or France, both of the countries are trying to mediate in the north, have the leverage on Hezbollah to get Hezbollah to withdraw under fire north of the Litani River. That's about 10 miles from our border. What a situation. Very grievous. And there's trendy things going on in the international region as well. The Palestinian Authority trying to declare get recognition of an independently declared Palestinian state through the United Nations and the Security Council. And the International Criminal Court threatening to publish extradition orders or arrest warrants for Prime Minister Netanyahu and other Israeli officials. All of that in a couple of days.
In the middle of that is a United States that in past generations would have been able to navigate this with authority, often navigating with a confused and mumbled message. One message that wasn't confusing is the threats that they might soon, if Israel proceeded with the Rafah incursion, cut off U.S. aid to Israel, even though Congress just approved it. How harmful would that be to the relationship? And does Israel have other contingencies should the U.S. stiffen on equipment and money?
Well, there are already reports that the United States is now holding up the delivery of essential munitions, especially artillery shells, tank shells, and what's known as JDAMs. These are our fighter-launched ground missiles. So that's already happening. It's not a cutoff, but it's a delay. The United States is denying it. We should say that. It's not going to impact Israel's sort of short-term calculus, certainly about going into Rafah. It may affect our long-term calculus with regard to Hezbollah. Because Hezbollah is not a tactical threat, it's a strategic threat. And you're talking about 150,000 to 170,000 rockets that are buried under 200 Lebanese villages. The IDF will have to go village to village, house to house. That's a tremendous amount of ordnance will be required to even reduce the Hezbollah rocket threat. So that could have an impact on our calculus, especially as other countries join in and take their cue from the United States, and other countries have done that. So people are taking their cue from Washington and taking their cue on other issues, too, certainly on the question of whether Israel would be deemed a war criminal or accused of genocide in the world by the International Criminal Court. The administration has said repeatedly that Israel has acted inhumanely toward the Palestinians, it killed too many Palestinians, it's bombed indiscriminately, and now intentionally causing famine. What does that all amount to? It could be Exhibit A, B, and C in one of these court cases. So it's not an easy situation for us vis-a-vis the administration. On the other hand, the administration has just voted through Congress, signed a bill with $26 billion worth of aid, and has so far blocked the attempts of the Palestinians to unilaterally declare a state in the Security Council, and appears to be poised to block International Criminal Court proceedings against Israeli leaders. We shall see.
Yeah. What is it that the U.S. and the American people can do to make sure that Israel prevails in this struggle against what is really a true evil enemy? What are the most important things that Israel could get from the United States right now that would make a difference in prevailing?
Okay, that is simple. And that is continued supply of vital ammunition, what I call the diplomatic Iron Dome, which is ensuring that we are protected from ICC and Security Council actions, and to give us the ability to pressure Hamas through acting militarily in the last redoubt of the Hamas leadership in Rafah. And Israel will do its utmost, as we always do, to minimize civilian casualties. But this is what I would like your listeners to keep in mind. In this country, this little bastion of democracy in an environment which is just unspeakably hostile to democracy and to freedom, you have 360,000 Israelis reporting for military duty. And 360,000 Israelis would be the equivalent of about 20 million Americans. And where do you find in the world a people that's willing to pick up arms, right? Like the men to pick up arms and leave their families, leave their homes, leave their jobs to go out and fight, knowing there's a good chance they're not coming back or not coming back in the same way. And where are you going to find that? And this is your ally. And they don't make allies like that in the world, because no one's going to go out and fight for Belgium. And no one's going to go out and fight for other countries in Europe either, not to give their lives for their countries. So you don't make allies like this. And you have to treasure it and protect it and do everything you can to make sure we win.
Coming up.
This is from a president who capitulated to the Taliban.
Cliff May, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Joe Biden's decision to withhold weapons from Israel is bad for Israel, of course. It's bad for their warfighting effort. The precision weapons from the U.S. help reduce civilian casualties as well. But it's arguably even worse for the message it sends to Hamas. Yahya Sinwar, the leader and presumed mastermind of the October 7th massacre, has got to be thinking, my delay tactics are working. If I delay further, we'll see a complete Israeli withdrawal. The president of the United States is on my side. The message would then be simple, a victory for Hamas. I turn to Cliff May of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Your reaction to President Biden's, I don't know, was it an announcement? Did he know what he was saying?
It's very disturbing. Look, Israel in recent days, weeks, months has been under attack by terrorists who proclaim openly that their intention is genocidal. I'm talking about Hamas, but of course I'm talking about also the Islamic Republic of Iran directly. I'm talking about Islamic Jihad. I'm talking about Hezbollah in the north. I'm talking about the Houthis, all of those. And suddenly, after having passed this bill, a lot of people voted for this bill because they wanted Israel to have it. There were Republicans, with whom I disagree, who didn't want the Ukrainians to have it. Suddenly, President Biden is saying, look, Israel can defend themselves, but they can't attack their enemy. We don't want to. They can only do that. This is from a president who capitulated to the Taliban and, in effect, to al-Qaeda. And he did so because he wanted to make a speech on the 20th anniversary of the attack. I fear that President Biden has become what Bernard Lewis, the great historian, warned against, which is an American president who is, as an enemy, harmless, and as an ally, is treacherous.
Wow. That's what I've been saying. I mean, I think the Biden doctrine is never don't disappoint an ally. Never escalate, never stand in the tough moment with an ally. So Cliff, Dr. Oren, former ambassador to Israel, was with me in hour one this morning. He said this decision leaves Israel in a position of exquisite vulnerability from the east, from the north, from the south, and that he is going to be on Israeli media today urging the war cabinet to move quickly into Rafah. What do you think they should do? What do you think they will do?
There are aspects of their capabilities that it's very hard for you or me to judge, to know all the things they can do. Certainly, if they can act surgically and continue to say to President Biden, we're not doing a full attack, you didn't want us to, we're not, but we've taken out, for example, the Philadelphia corridor, that's the border between Gaza and Egypt. There are huge tunnels under that border, and weapons have been coming in for years and probably were and may still be. But now the Israelis can stop the resupply of weapons through that corridor from Egypt. That was a surgical and very, very precise mission, and they did it. Maybe they have 10 more missions like that they can do that are very clear, and they can keep saying, you need to supply us. We're listening to you. We're not doing a full front assault against Hamas, which, as you know, is using human shields. That is illegal under international law. That's illegal, but it's also very effective for them to do. So please continue. But it's not clear at all to the Israelis what it is that Biden's going to do or not to do at this point. He's an unreliable ally. Keep in mind that Israel has had some experience with this sort of thing. When the Israelis decided they were going to destroy the Osirik reactor, nuclear reactor in Iraq, the Americans said, don't do it. No, it's going too far. They did it anyway. And Jean Kirkpatrick, who I knew fairly well, she said, I had to denounce the Israelis at the UN, but I knew I shouldn't be doing it. I knew they had done the right thing. When the Israelis took out the North Korean-built nuclear reactor in Syria, the U.S. also said, don't do that, please. No, that's too aggressive. They did it. Everybody knows they were right to have done it. And even the Six-Day War of 1967, President Johnson said, you need to take some hits before you do it. You can't fight the way they wanted to, led to a Six-Day War. In other words, Israel has been many times on its own alone, and it may have to be on its own alone this time, too, to do what's necessary to win, not just have a frozen conflict. It seems like in the West, we don't want to win. We don't want our enemies to lose. You can apply that to Ukraine, it seems to me. You can apply that to a lot of places where the U.S. policy is to somehow concede and appease and see if that isn't sufficient.
Cliff, yesterday I was listening to commentary on Dan Senor, and I walked a total of 9 miles. You know, that's two sides of Gaza, of Rafah, Rafah is only 25 square miles total. I don't understand how you suspend precision munitions and don't get civilians killed or IDF soldiers killed or absolutely empower Sinwar. What am I missing here?
You're not missing anything, I think, President Biden, is the extent that the Israelis have precision munitions, they will use them, and they will be more precise about killing enemies and doing their best not to kill human shields. They have already said very clearly, no other armies do this, here's where you need to leave because here's where we'll be attacking. And there are those who say, no, I want to be a human shield, I want to be a martyr. But to the extent that President Biden would help Israel to be precise, there will be fewer civilian deaths.
Coming up, Victor Davis Hanson on our campus protest.
These people are pro-Hamas, Marxist, radical Islamists, and a bunch of useful idiots, spoiled kids.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
John Solomon provides exclusive reporting and newsmaker interviews on John Solomon Reports on the Salem Podcast Network.
We broke this story because we got the documents early. They put out this new information, and it affirms our reporting that this Democrat donor gave about $5 million or more in assistance to Hunter Biden, basically paid off his bills.
Subscribe to John Solomon Reports today on Apple, Spotify, Google, Rumble, or at SalemPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Campus protests against Israel continue this week. Right here in D.C., Mayor Muriel Bowser, after dragging her feet for weeks, used the Metropolitan Police Department to clear out an illegal encampment at the George Washington University.
Israel will come.
And there's example after example on the campuses of some of the most elite universities across the nation. Genocide Joe, that's what the protesters call Joe Biden, and the Democrats have created what Victor Davis Hanson has called a Frankensteinian monster. Here's Victor, joined with Jack Fowler on his podcast.
The subtext everybody's missing is that these students are all on some type of support, whether they're parental support, or us, the taxpayers, student subsidized loans, or the university support. And they live in a la-la land. So we had that one student at Columbia that was had that crazy PhD thesis on the intersectionality of gender and Marxist this and that. And then she's out there demanding that they give her food while they destroy the classics department at Columbia. And here at UCLA, those video images of what those people did to that campus, it was just shocking. I mean, there was garbage everywhere. They destroyed things. They threw trash. And who did they think was going to pick up after them? It's going to be poor people who work in maintenance and janitorial services, mostly minorities that they champion. So they're completely selfish little brats. It's really a class thing. They don't care about the maintenance people that take care of them and clean up after them when they're at universities. And when they trash the yard, they don't care about the middle class police. They're the most spoiled generation you can imagine. And then the president and all these blue state, anywhere there's a president in a blue state, blue city, you know that he's a leftist. You know that he got to where he is by appeasing or being a leftist. The faculty are leftists. The protesters are all leftists. The mayors are leftists. The city councils are leftists. And the governor's leftist. And so they condone and they promote this. Anywhere there's a red state university with a mayor and city council and governor that conservative, even if the president, who probably is left-wing, and the faculty, they can't do anything. There's order and calm. This is really a referendum on the failures of this whole progressive touch that turns everything to dross. Everything they touch, they destroy. The border, jurisprudence, energy, foreign policy. It's a Marxist party now, and it doesn't work. And they get violent and angry, and they're not nice people.
In real time, we're seeing the dismantling of these Jacobins at UCLA and the realization of the talking heads that this is going to have of political ramifications. This violence is going to, quote unquote, help Trump. Now, how come the violence of 2020 did not help Donald Trump.
As a generic rule, Joe Biden, remember, demagogued the issue. He says, Trump is in charge when the violence, he owns it. So, of course, that boomeranged back on him. But as a general rule, anytime there's violence and people get sick of it, they blame the incumbent president. That's number one. Number two, the media covered that violence of 2020, which was 120 days, as I keep saying, 35 people were killed, 1,500 police officers plus were injured, $2 billion went up in smoke, and they attacked federal courthouse, police precincts, iconic churches. They tried to get at Trump, and 14,000 arrests, most of them were let go. But the media said it was largely peaceful, or it was a summer of love, or Donald Trump wanted to send in the National Guard. So it was very hard for him. He would have been much better just to ignore everything and send in the National Guard and restore calm. But he couldn't do that, he thought, because the election was coming up. Remember, Kamala Harris said, this is not going to stop. This is going to continue, nor should it stop. It's going to go all the way to the election. Molly Ball, on that infamous Time essay of February 2021, said, this was how we won. We had a cabal. We modulated the protest so they would continue all the way to the election. So it was very hard for Trump when the media and the Democratic Party was hand in glove orchestrating this. But now they've created a Frankensteinian monster, and they never thought it would apply to them. They thought if there were protests, they would be against supposed conservative right-wingers. But they're not, because these people are crazy. These are pro-Hamas, Marxist, radical Islamicists and a bunch of useful idiot spoiled kids. And now all of a sudden it's Genocide Joe, and he can't control it. And he could win if he would restore order, but then he's afraid that the Muslim community wouldn't vote for him. I don't know who they're going to vote for. Who do they think they're going to vote for? Robert Kennedy, maybe? Donald Trump? I don't think so. But the point is that now the youth vote, Jack, people under 30, Trump is ahead in that cohort because these people aren't the majority of the youth vote. A lot of people are sick of all this, especially young people. Half, 60% of the young people now don't go to college. Right. And when they see this student loan giveaway, they're not empathetic for some spoiled brat, PhD, art history major that gets $80,000 forgiven when they get nothing and they have to pay for it when they're payroll taxes and regular income tax withholding.
Victor, I saw a negotiation, I think it was from SUNY New Paltz, and the wimpiest college president in history who is arguing with those of his own kind of ideological ilk. And how can they have it both ways, Victor? How can they be on a level where someone in charge of a public institution talks to them like they're equals, but yet, as we saw the mantra coming out on MSNBC, their children, or the mayor of New York, we have to protect the children, and they're being, you know, the provocateurs in the crowd. What are they? Are they babies, or are they?
I think the problem is, Jack, that there's children talking to children. Just because these people have adult bodies, the faculty and these administrators, doesn't mean they're adults. They went right to graduate school. They went to undergraduate. They didn't drive a taxi. They didn't go get on a tractor. They didn't drive a semi. They didn't have a summer job hauling trash for somebody. They went right to graduate school. And then when they went to graduate school, they went right to faculty. And they got automatic lifetime tenure after a measly 5 or 6 years. And then they went into administration. So when you see these college presidents and provosts and deans and faculty talking to the students, it's like your kids talking to another kid, but one of them has an adult body. But that doesn't mean they're adults. They're all prolonged adolescent because they've never been in the real world.
Coming up.
So they're in loony land.
A few more minutes with Victor Davis Hanson in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Charlie Kirk here. It is critical we keep AM radio in all cars and all trucks. More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for news, weather, and opinions. AM is also the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping you advised of threatening weather conditions and amber alerts. Text AM to number 52886. Tell Congress that we need AM radio in our cars. Again, text AM to the number 528 86, standard message and data rates may apply.
Our campus! Our campus! Our campus! We will not stop! We will not rest!
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As we look at the messes on so many campuses across the nation, many Americans have received a wake-up call. They knew things on campus were bad. They didn't realize things were this bad. And all of it, or virtually all of it, is undergirded by tax dollars. Let's pick up with more of Victor Davis Hanson with his co-host, Jack Fowler.
We're subsidizing all of this. We, the taxpayers, we're subsidizing these loans. We're giving that income on $8 billion of an endowment tax-free status. We're sending millions of dollars without conditions and stock, and people give stock to them for tax purposes. And we don't have to do that. And the funny thing is, there's fewer students. Costs have gone up way above the rate of inflation. And the teaching loads have gone down. The Club Med environment has increased, where you get latte bars and rock climbing, and the dorms look like they're, you know, penthouses. And the result, it doesn't pencil out. So one of the ways they square the circle is they get a million foreign students and they charge them top, you know, plus. They don't get any discount. These students come over here, if they're Chinese, or they're all from illiberal and Middle East, they're all from illiberal regimes. And they don't appreciate the liberality and affluence and leisure of the United States. They look at it as decadence and they take advantage of it. And the whole paradigm, when they interview these students, Jack, and they ask them, river to the sea, which river, which sea? They have no idea what the Jordan River is. So even the Middle Eastern students can't answer that. They ask them why they were there. I don't know why I'm here. They ask them, what do you mean by 1947? I don't know. What do you mean by global intifada? I don't know. They don't know anything because the faculty has watered down the curriculum because for the last 3 to 4 years, they let in people with no SAT score and no adjudication of their GPA. And, you know, in Stanford, they let in a guy who wrote Black Lives Matter 100 times. And then they had an article in the San Jose Mercury bragging that Stanford did that almost 70% of those who chose to take an optional SAT and got a perfect score, they rejected. So they're in learning land. And the only good thing about this is not all the universities are. So there's an enormous opportunity for the University of Tennessee's, the Vanderbilts, Cal State Fresno, where I taught. If they wanted to, they could step up and say, we have standards and come over here. If you're right. Jewish and you're going to be attacked on campus, come down to the University of Alabama. Alabama is a much more liberal, tolerant place than New York City or Chicago. Isn't that ironic to say? It is. And we'll protect you. I think that's what's happening to these universities. They don't know what they're doing. They've gone full Bud Light. They've gone full Target. They've gone full Disney. And that's when I wrote that column that everything the left touches, it destroys.
Thank you for joining the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoyed the program and podcast, do us the favor of sharing it with a friend. Let me point out, you can get this podcast, Town Hall Review, Victor Davis Hanson, John Solomon Reports, and my own podcast, Highly Concentrated Hugh, all at SalemPodcastNetwork.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers David Pouchon, Alex Perez, Harley Eide, Adam Ramsey, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.